You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by SEIU Local 1 and Blake and Ulig P. Service Employees International Union, that's SEIU Local 1, gives workers and working families a voice in fighting for respect and dignity on the job. Our members are janitors in Kansas City and surrounding suburbs and local sports entertainment staff. And Blake and Ulig, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, comedian and social commentator Lee Camp asks not if robots will get your job, but who will benefit when they do. Then, with football kicking off this month, we'll have historian Chuck Ross to explain how matters of race and class are taking the center stage at colleges and at the pros. In the news, in the wake of last week's overwhelming vote to raise the minimum wage, Kansas City and St. Louis workers are telling the governor and legislature to get out of the way and let them have their raise. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams. She'll talk about the First Amendment and armed demonstrators. Now for the news.
This afternoon, the Missouri-Kansas City Committee to Protect Pensions organized a crowd of active and retired Teamsters, family and friends, other union and non-union members, to pack the hall of the American Legion Post 21 in Independence for a meeting with U.S. Senator Claire McCaskill. The retirees want a reasonable solution to the retirement security issues that have been plaguing our nation. According to the committee, monies earned for retirement have been lost, stolen, mismanaged, or squandered by greedy investors through no fault of the retirees involved. Senator McCaskill has no trouble recognizing the tremendous inequities of placing the responsibility of pension deficits on the backs of members. She's keenly aware of the unacceptable burden on the state and local economies and the subsequent domino effect on other pension plans. She has said, quote, "Retirement security is not a local issue. It demands national attention," end quote. The senator recently endorsed S. 1076, quote, "Keeping Our Pension Promises Act," sponsored by Bernie Sanders, in the Senate, and H.R. 2412, its counterpart in the House, sponsored by Marcy Kepler. John C. Anderson, a member of MKCCPP, said, quote, "Our legislative support is on the rise and is directly related to our members' demands. However, there's a myriad of quick-fix proposals that are vying to serve the interests of the entities they represent. The committee wants a thoughtful and carefully considered debate of all proposals. In the meantime," they say, "Senator McCaskill's unwavering support of an equitable solution to the retirement security question is greatly appreciated by all Missourians, indeed, by all American working families."
At noon today, about 80 fast food workers, union members, clergy, and allies gathered in front of a McDonald's restaurant in Kansas City to send the message that they want the minimum wage ordinance passed last week by over 70% of voters in Kansas City to be respected. Workers in St. Louis have already gotten pledges from over 100 employers that they will not roll back the $10 minimum wage enacted this summer, but preempted by the state legislature. Stand-up KC activist Terrence Wise aimed the crowd at the obstructionism of the Missouri government.
"And last week, the vote for 15 shows us that what we're doing is right, and we're winning, and we should own that. And that's not our only message we're out here to send today. We're out here to send a message to Jefferson City, like I said in the beginning, to get out the way. And you see the signs, pay the wage, and that's a great trend, great chant. But join me in a new chant we got. And it's simple, out the way. So we want to tell Jeff City and any elected leader across the country who's standing in the way of raising wages for working families to get out the way. Get out the way. Get out the way. Get out the way.
Reverend Rodney Williams drove the message home.
Although the politicians have stolen our wages, after the people have spoken, after the people have fought, but I stand to remind you that they know and we know the motto. Let the good of the people be the supreme law.
All right.
We know that the Constitution of Missouri states that government is intended to promote the general welfare of the people. Interruptions are good.
Hey.
They allow us to gather ourselves.
All right.
And to move on a little further, you have had an interruption, and the interruption is the preemptive laws. But we have come to tell the politicians that no preemptive laws are going to stop us.
Bridget Hughes, a fast food worker, eloquently expressed the sacrifices that low-wage parents and their children make every day to the greed of companies like Burger King or McDonald's.
Hello, my name is Bridget Hughes. I work for Burger King where I make $9.50 an hour and I'm a mother of four. I've recently obtained a second job just to make ends meet. I've started organizing with Stand Up KC 3 years ago because I shouldn't have to choose between paying my bills and being a mother.
All right.
So I want to take you through one of my days. I wake up in the morning and I go to Burger King. I see several different faces all day long that I serve food to. I keep my store organized and running on time. I work hard, often without a break. And by the time I get home, my house is dark. My kids are in bed, sleeping for school the next day. I didn't get to give my kids a bath. I didn't get to read them a story before bed. There was no family meal where we sat together and talked about our days, despite the fact that I ask thousands of people about their day every day. My kids tell me I don't have time for them. They say, Mommy, we never see you. You're always working. And I do. I'm always at work. I missed the first day of school. It was Desmond's first day of kindergarten, and he was so excited. And I didn't get to be there for him. I missed my oldest son's ice cream social, where I got to meet his teachers and see his classroom.
All right, baby.
I feel like I'm missing out on my life because every decision I make in my life is for my children. But I work so much that I can't be there for them. And I'm not the only parent who goes through this.
All right.
There are hundreds of thousands of Missourians who make poverty wages, and nobody in America should have to choose between their kids and their job.
All right.
When politicians stand in our way of winning $15, they are standing in the way of parents being able to be the mothers and fathers that we are supposed to be.
All right.
This is a democracy, and the people voted and voiced what they want and what they need. Kansas City wants $15, and our representatives need to respect that and get out of the way.
All right.
And we are not just stopping at calling at these politicians. We are going to continue our call at our employers, billion-dollar companies that we work for that can afford to pay us the wages we deserve.
All right.
We need them to make the choice to do what is right. We have always called for $15 in a union because that is what we deserve.
Yes.
All right.
Finally, Reverend Vernon Howard, who led the petition effort, which culminated in last week's vote to raise Kansas City's minimum wage to $10 by August 24th and $15 by 2022, called on every level of government and every low-wage employer to raise wages to $10 next week and send the legislature and governor the message that with or without a law, wages will go up. That's the news from our side. The news was read by Jake White, and I'm Judy Ansel.
misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, or what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate. Only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power. Let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world. Decent world that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill that promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
A new study out of Oxford and Yale shows that artificial intelligence experts, AI experts, believe there's a 50% chance AI will surpass humans in jobs within 45 years, and a 10% chance they'll do it in 9 years. These are the experts. If you're an average human being, you now think to yourself, they mean jobs like laying bricks or sweeping up, certainly not jobs like mine of fill-in job that requires moderate level of skill or creativity. Nobody wants a bot to fill in tasks that makes you make it sound, you know, interesting and personal, and then insert nervous laughter. But in fact, this study is talking about all jobs, including things like surgeon, author, salesperson, barista who puts a little flair in the design on the top of your cappuccino because he finds you attractive and he's hoping that you realize he's really more of an artist than a coffee maker. Bots will be able to do all of these jobs. And it's a testament to our simple brains that most of us think AI won't be capable of any form of creative thought or deep analysis such as a doctor puts into making a diagnosis. But in fact, in many ways, bots already beat out doctors. In fact, one algorithm that was created using the steps human doctors go through to make a diagnosis ended up beating the doctors at making diagnoses. So, you know, an algorithm created from the thought process of human doctors was more correct than the human doctors that created it. How's that possible? Well, the bot took out the human factor. It was less likely to get distracted by things that didn't matter, or by the fact that it was hungry or angry, or to assess probabilities incorrectly. Now, well, just wait a second, and don't yourself just yet. And if you do, just know that a bot will be able to itself better than you ever could in 10 years. The AI revolution that is actually already taking place will be a wonderful thing for humanity, for you and me and everyone, if we deal with it correctly. And that if is a giant if. It's the biggest if you've ever seen, with the possible exception of that time you found out that that girl or guy you really, really liked was actually gay or straight or would totally sleep with you if you were the opposite gender of what you actually are. Ifs can be a real bitch sometimes. Anyway, if we accept our fate that bots will be doing basically every job, including writing best-selling novels and pop songs within 100 years, then it should clear the way for an awesome jobless future in which we simply enjoy our lives and focus on growing our minds, exploring the heavens and appreciating the mere cosmic seconds in which we grasp something resembling awareness. Or you could just play Call of Duty for all those years, whatever your choice. You will be able to follow your passion. The point is that we're rapidly heading towards a jobless future, and we already have the technological ability to feed, clothe, and house every human on the planet. We just don't do it because unfettered capitalism tells us we need to let the poor suffer immeasurably so that we can be rich. And I don't mean rich as in owning three yachts, two of which are backup yachts for when your main yacht still has dirty sheets on the bed. I'm talking about rich as in just having a house and income and basically all the food you want. You know, don't think we could actually feed everyone in the world. The U.S. throws away 40% of all our food every year. So if we have the ability to take care of everyone and we have a future in which the bots will be doing almost all the jobs, why does it seem that we are planning for a future in which we all work harder than ever to make less money than ever, to enjoy our lives less than ever? Why do that? Why do we do that? It comes down to a societal mental illness. Getting people to see outside of it is incredibly difficult. How do you break people of an operating system that practically consumes all our cultural consciousness? It's like trying to explain to a water spider or water strider, whatever those little things are on the top of the pool. It's like trying to explain to him that he's lived his entire life only on the surface of the water, and there's an entire world just below his feet, even though he's never noticed. Although, I imagine every once in a while something living down in the pool comes up and eats one of his friends. So maybe water spiders are, in fact, acutely aware of the world below them and want nothing to do with it, in which case I apologize for this analogy. There are half steps to get to a much better future, things like basic income. The basic income movement says that every single citizen should get paid a monthly stipend, let's say $1,000 a month, whether they work or not. This makes a lot more sense than you immediately think it does. And studies show that it would be a huge success. Studies show it doesn't harm productivity or anything else. It would eliminate homelessness and hunger in our society to begin with. And believe it or not, even Florida, yes, crazy-ass Florida, recently noticed that housing and taking care of homeless actually saves the city money. California just found out that giving everyone single-payer health care actually saves the state money. They then, you know, vetoed it because the Democrats are as bought by big pharma as the and big insurance companies as the right wing is, but still, they did know that it saves the state money. Look, our thinking is backwards. Our society is set up wrong. The jobs are going away. We need to start rethinking our world before we allow a deep delusion to devour us whole.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Tino Scalisi. Joining us on the phone from his Washington apartment is comedian, writer, and host of RT's Redacted Tonight, Mr. Lee Camp. We're going to be talking to Lee about a bit that he did on artificial intelligence. The entire labor movement seems to hinge, in fact and in spirit, on the premise of, quote, good jobs for all. That is, of course, unless you actually have to do the work. And so, first, Lee, welcome to the show. Welcome to Heartland Labor Forum.
Thank you, Tia. Good to talk to you again.
So we were listening to your bit, and so besides shooting screws or picking up trash or entertaining primetime audiences, for example, what other worthwhile human activity is there? I mean, like, what else would we be doing if we weren't, you know, so busy doing these sorts of things?
Right, and even back in the 1970s when technology was starting to get pretty impressive, a lot of theorists talked about that we would soon be in a time of leisure. We would soon lead a leisure existence. Now this means that it doesn't mean you'd be bored out of your mind. You could follow your passion, whether that's art or creativity or, you know, building something or, you know, yes, there would be a certain degree of people that just fritter away their life with video games, but I guess there's people that do that now as well.
Right.
And if you believe in a free society, if there are fewer jobs and you don't have to work at a job you hate, then you have the freedom to waste your existence on perhaps a video game or something. But there are plenty of things that people could follow if they were able to just follow their passion. But, of course, most of us don't live that existence. Very few of us are able to just do what we want.
Right.
And the truth is we could get there, except we aren't even willing to have the discussion.
So where do you think this national romance with work or keeping busy comes from? You know, I was listening to a bit of Redacted tonight where you were talking about, you know, as a nation, like when we're out in public and we see like a homeless person on the street who got a violin and we'd be more happy to give him money, you know, provided that he's doing some sort of work. Where do you think that national romance is with someone just being busy? Why do we care so much about that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you kind of can separate work from a job. I'm all for people want to, you know, working if they want to work, doing whatever it is that they love doing. A job, though, is, for a lot of people, it's a job they don't want to have, or at least they don't want to have it for the amount of time they have to do it each day.
Right.
So our national romance with jobs comes pretty directly from the corporate mindset. You know, when politicians say they want to bring back jobs, for them and for corporations, it means they want to bring back profits.
Right.
And they want to get votes, obviously. But they jobs are profits for corporations. But what they've done is they've slowly gutted the working class, both the number of jobs being shipped to technology and shipped overseas and decreasing or keeping the minimum wage stale for, you know, decades after decades while the CEO pay shoots through the roof.
Right.
And so they've basically created a system that can't sustain itself. We don't have a working class making enough money to buy the things that the corporations are making. And the way they were able to sustain this when this first started happening in the 70s was debt. They found out about, hey, if we just let everybody buy everything on credit card debt and all kinds of debt, we can keep this system going. Well, yeah, but you can't keep that going forever. So now we're all swamped in debt. Apparently the numbers are that 50% of Americans can't actually deal with a $500 emergency.
Wow.
Without going deeper into debt. And so the system is completely unsustainable, but they are short-term, these corporations are short-term greedy, and so they're going for what makes them the dollar in the next few weeks and months.
Sure.
Rather than what would sustain this system long-term. So we've got a completely unsustainable system based on the wage slavery of, you know, whatever it is, 80% of the population.
Well, do you think that There's been talk before about, and we've covered this on the show before, and you've talked about it a little bit yourself, about this thing of a universal income. But I think that as Americans, and I'm sure that it extended from the Protestant work ethic that I don't understand at all,
mm-hmm.
but that, you know, that people need to work in order to earn a living. And so do you think that something like a universal income in the United States, do you think that something like that is possible? I think that there's a special sort of situation here in the United States where it just doesn't seem like we would be ready for it. What do you think?
Well, first of all, in terms of the universal income, it is a half step towards kind of a better society. It's, you know, some people will point out that it's kind of a Band-Aid over a system that can't sustain. It allows people to keep working in this system without going homeless or whatever, but it's
sure.
not going to actually fix the core root of the problem. And I agree with that. I think it's a half step. I don't think it's the end goal. But in terms of why, you know, we talk about work and how important it is and everything, I think anybody will find the work that's important to them. You know, if it turns out that they're independently wealthy, then what if those people do all day? Well, most of them do some kind of work, whether it's, you know, whether they like planting a garden or they, you know, like cooking, and so they spend 2 hours cooking dinner rather than the 2 minutes most of us spend microwaving a Hot Pocket. So people find the work that is meaningful to them or what they want to do. It's just a different kind of work than the, you know, I'm gonna be stuck on the factory line all day.
Sure.
I don't think that one of those intrinsically is a better thing than the other. I think that hard work that's rewarding and that you enjoy doing can be important in life.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't put one over the other just because one is, I don't know, harder or one's earning money for a corporation. That doesn't necessarily make it a better form of work.
Sure. Do you think that there's a political motivation? Not that anyone on community radio would ever get into conspiracy theories here, but I mean, do you think that there's a conspiracy on the part, if not on the federal government or at some sort of a national level, that keeping the working class busy and engaged in the sort of industrial activities that will leave them diminished at the end of their day. Do you think that it keeps them from engaging in any kind of, I'm leading the witness here, but like keeping them from engaging in the kind of activities that would threaten the status quo? Do you think that that's a part of it, or...
Yeah, and it's not just some conspiracy that you thought up in your head. It's actually, we have written documents that this was kind of planned out to some degree. Now, it doesn't mean that every step is a bunch of men sitting around in a room, but some of them are. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Chomsky often talks about the Trilateral Commission and the Crisis of Democracy paper they put out, as well as on the right side. So that's kind of on the neoliberal, somewhat left-wing side.
Sure.
On the right-wing side is the Powell memo. And both of these things together happened in the, I think they were both in the 70s, when people were becoming kind of free-spirited in the 60s and 70s, free-spirited hippie children and standing up and spending a lot of time fighting the war movements. And the ruling elite got together of, you know, Trilateral Commission was multi-nation, and they said, we have too many people engaging in democracy, engaging in activism, engaging in the voting system. How do we get our control back? And they came up with a variety of steps they needed to take, and pretty much all of those have been taken. You know, some of them is that the universities need to stop teaching kind of outside of the box stuff, the indebting people by forcing them into expensive college tuition is another way to force people to work for most of their lives, and another is to make the media in general follow the line, the talking points of the state. And, you know, so those things were laid out in documents which you can go online and read, and most of them have come true, you know, to a large extent.
And speaking of engaging in democracy, you know, we talked very briefly last night. I guess you were engaged in some sort of democratic public action yesterday. We've got news that there were some people injured in an anti-racist or anti-fascist demonstration yesterday. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Do you want to talk about it? I know you must be shooken up. What's going on?
You know, I haven't put all my thoughts together on it yet, but I was in Charlottesville at the anti-fascist, anti-white supremacist rallies that were going there. I also went to school in Charlottesville, UVA, and I had only been there for about 10 minutes, and I was a little bit there in a press manner a bit, because I filmed these things and post them as part of Redacted Tonight or our web videos or whatever, so I was kind of filming it on my phone, and pretty much the first 10 minutes I'm there, there's the maniac who drove over about 20 people, that all happened about 10 feet from me.
Oh my God.
And, we now know that one person has died from that. The man has been caught and is facing murder charges. There's also photos of him at white supremacist rallies. So it's not just theory that this guy did this intentionally. And it's truly horrific. And I think people need to not just stand up against this hate. And, you know, there's a lot of different things that this points to in our society. You know, why are people so angry? What is happening to our society? And I'm going to save us kind of a deeper analysis of that. But I think people just need to be brave and stand up against this kind of thing. And, you know, it is a question of how long will you let this go on? How many immigrants will you allow to be abused before it's your problem? And, you know, I'm one of these people that thinks that the corporate Democrats are as harmful to the long-term sustainability and stability of this country and this planet. But that doesn't mean that I can't understand how horrific a group like these white nationalists are. So I think we do need to stand up for our neighbors and our communities and really realize that this is a problem for all of us that believe in inequality, believe in stopping bigotry and racism. You know, there's the famous quote about, first they came for the trade unionist, and I didn't stand up because I wasn't a trade unionist. And next they came for the, you know, fill in the blank, and I didn't stand up because I wasn't the fill in the blank.
Sure.
And then when they came for me, there was no one left to stand up. And that was said about World War II, but it's you can see it now as ICE is raiding people's homes, and when will we stand up? So, you know, it is a horrific thing that I witnessed, and I hope nobody ever has to has to witness something like that, but I hope that we continue to think as a nation about how we can use this fleeting moments of consciousness that we all get make a difference in this world, and I hope we're all thinking about how we can best do that.
Let's hope. And Lee, thank you again so much for not only joining us on the show today, but bearing witness to what was happening in Charlottesville and taking a stand. Hopefully this doesn't have a chilling effect. Hopefully this inspires people to engage even more fully in the democratic process and the democratic experiment that is in the United States of America. And again, thank you so much. This is Lee Camp coming to us over the phone from Washington, D.C. You can check him out on RT America with his show Redacted. That was Redacted Tonight. So guys, what did you think? So we had Charlie Chaplin doing his great dictator speech at the top of the show, and then we spoke with Lee Camp a little bit in a brief interview, and we listened to his bit on automation. If you like that, please join us at the Heartland Labor Forum on 90.1 FM KKFI on Thursday evenings at 6 o'clock. And thank you so much.
KKFI Crossroads Music Fest is here again. Saturday, September 9th in Kansas City's Crossroads Arts District. Over 35 bands on 9 stages. Tickets are on sale now for just $20. The festival is a diverse slice of the music scene in the area. This year's artists include The Fantastics, Enrique Chi of Making Movies, Javier Mendoza, Crystal Rose, Barclay Martin, Duncan Burnett and Riot, Sarah Morgan, Kelly Hunt, Mundo Nuevo, Kyle Reed, Instant Karma, Hot Club KC, and many more. Saturday, September 9th, the Crossroads Music Fest, a benefit for KKFI. Tickets and more info are available at cmfkc.com.
KKFI is sustained by generous listener support. Thank you for 30 years of belief in Kansas City Community Radio.
Hi, welcome back to Heartland Labor Forum. Another great segment by Tino there. This is Jacob White. Earlier this week, I was really lucky to speak to Professor Chuck Ross from Ole Miss. You guys might remember him from last year. It's a really great interview. I'm really glad we were able to talk again, and I hope you enjoy it.
Wait a minute.
That was Dr. Chuck Ross from Ole Miss. We had him on around this time last year, and we'll be sure to have him on sooner and not wait a whole year until we have him on again. I'm Jacob White. This is Heartland Labor Forum. So joining us today on Heartland Labor Forum, we're really lucky to have back Professor Chuck Ross from the History Department at the University of Mississippi. Dr. Ross has written several books about the issue of race in sports, and we were lucky to have him on last year around this time, sort of just to talk about the Chiefs and their history and talk about the football season coming up. And then a few weeks after we had you on, Dr. Ross, there was suddenly a whole lot more to talk about in terms of current events. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's been a lot of developments that have taken place, particularly NFL, college sports, college football. So there's a lot of things we probably could definitely touch on.
I know. It's almost hard to go with where to begin. Even just in the last week, there's been a few really important issues that have come up. So maybe because, you know, you are a professor and we are heading back into school, maybe it would be okay if we started with college football. Is that okay with you?
Sounds good.
All right. So in the last week, one of the highest profile college football athletes, quarterback at UCLA named Josh Rosen, said that being a student and being a football player at the same time was, these aren't his exact words, but he said it was pretty much impossible. And then he also talked about the academic standards being different for student athletes and there really being a problem with finding a correct balance between being a student and being an athlete. So as a big college football fan and as someone who spends most of their time on a college campus, how did you take Josh Rosen's words, and do you think that he has a valid point?
Yeah, I think the young man definitely has a valid point. I know his coach, Mora, has been trying to meet with him, And my take on it is that the head football coach at UCLA, Coach Moore, has been trying to get him to temper those comments in the public that, you know, if you feel like that, let's try to work through this in-house. Because, you know, clearly we're talking about a very contradictory kind of system, in that there's no necessary real difference between pro football and college football outside of college football players are not compensated. They spend a tremendous amount of time lifting weights, preparing, going to film, practicing. And the young man is right. I mean, in a certain sense, there's a little bit more responsibility because then you have to go to class and you have to perform at a certain level to maintain your eligibility. And his argument is that, well, you know, in order to maintain your eligibility, in a lot of cases, you are funneled into courses or majors that don't have necessarily a whole lot of academic rigor. And the idea is that, well, not necessarily look out for the welfare of this student athlete, in that want to make sure you go into a major and that you can graduate and then use that degree to go and further yourself professionally once you leave college football. The idea is that put you potentially in an area or major where an individual can have a much more likelihood of being successful and staying eligible. That's the idea, that eligibility is very, very, very important. So, you know, he's making a strong argument. Then the other side of it is the economics, in that Coach Mora, Coach Saban, Coach Meyer at Ohio State, Coach at Nebraska, all are making, you know, $3, $4, $5, $6, $7 million a year. And you have these student athletes that are not being compensated. So that's another component of this, is that I think, you know, he is again broaching the idea that the young men began to kind of broach at Northwestern, that student athletes should be compensated, particularly those in this, in the sport that generates the most revenue on Division I campuses, and of course that course we talk about college football.
And in response to this situation, a writer for Sports Illustrated, John Taylor, he made the point that it's interesting that the young men who have stepped out about this have come from Northwestern or from UCLA, and ordinarily if you can get into one of those schools, it means you come from a pretty privileged background. Do you think that Josh Rosen, coming from a very secure background, has allowed him to speak out more than maybe someone who grew up in the rural South and is at Alabama now?
Yeah, I think that they're coming from a probably socioeconomic situation where they have a lot more stability. And everything is not, in terms of their socialization and upbringing, is not geared around you've got to be successful in going to college. Don't cause any troubles. Don't rock the boat. Don't get involved in anything politically. You know, and so this is a real opportunity for you to come to college and parlay that into potentially going on to the National Football League. So, you know, he has probably a lot more options, and those athletes at Northwestern the same in terms of, and then, you know, probably a little bit more exposure to concepts about the world and the United States and how things work. And so they have a little bit different perspective in terms of educationally about this complex system that they're in, to where that they can begin to, you know, poke at it, question it, and make statements about it, and make arguments about the idea that athletes should be compensated. But, you know, I would tell that writer for Sports Illustrated, that's not the issue. The issue is not about the socioeconomic status of, well, these athletes from UCLA and these athletes from Northwestern simply because they come from a different kind of situation. They have the ability to speak out. He almost is insinuating that, well, if they come from some urban area and where, you know, athletes are coming on campus and they're very, very grateful for this opportunity, then they're going to be quiet. But because these guys are coming from a little bit more privileged situation, they have the luxury of being able to speak out. That's not the issue. The issue is an economic issue, and it's an issue in which you've got to be honest in that when you look at these, the Power Five conferences in this country that play college football Division One level, along with Notre Dame, these institutions and these conferences are making a tremendous amount of money. And they're making a lot of, most of this money because they're not having to pay the labor force. And that's just the bottom line. If you went to Jerry Jones and said, listen, only thing we want to be able to give your football players is some kind of a living stipend and the opportunity to have a few sandwiches after the football game, an opportunity for them to have books, but you have to pay them a salary. Jerry Jones would jump on that, I mean, like yesterday. Okay, so this is about the economics of labor and compensating labor. And the bottom line is that, you know, these Division One schools have a very, very, very beneficial system that allows them to exploit their labor under the auspices of the student athlete kind of model that, in essence, says, we are doing you a favor for allowing you to come on our campus for 4 to 5, maybe 6 years to get an education. And the reality is that they're not the average student. They're not really there to necessarily get an education. They're there to play football and represent their institutions. And so that's the issue, not that these individuals are coming from a kind of privileged background that allows them to speak out more so than other athletes.
We're talking to Dr. Chuck Ross. He's a historian from the University of Mississippi. Let's switch gears and talk a little bit about the NFL. In a little under 2 weeks, Spike Lee, the acclaimed filmmaker, is going to be having a rally outside of the NFL headquarters. And we know a lot of that is going to be about the fact that Colin Kaepernick still does not have an NFL job. So let's just get straight to the point. Do you think that Cap is being blackballed by the owners? Do you think that he should have a job by now?
Absolutely. It's really not about what I think. Let's look at Colin Kaepernick's year last year with the San Francisco 49ers, a team that is in transition, in essence, at one time he led to the Super Bowl, but has really shed many of the integral parts that were key to that team being very, very successful in getting to the Super Bowl. Of course, their coach is not there any longer. They've really kind of decimated their defense, and many of the weapons on the offensive side of the ball are not there anymore, including one, say, Michael Crabtree. Yet, Colin Kaepernick threw 16 touchdowns and 4 interceptions last year. Now, if you can find a quarterback in the NFL that can give you a 50-50 production, in many cases, they really have an opportunity to be looked at and be, you know, given, you know, every kind of chance to continue to show that they have that kind of skill set to lead a team at the quarterback position. 16 touchdowns and 4 interceptions. That's an incredible ratio. And so there have been all of this, there's all of this kind of rhetoric that has been surrounding Colin Kaepernick since he led the team to the Super Bowl. All of a sudden, his skill set has now diminished, that he doesn't read defenses as well. He's not really a pocket passer. His accuracy is still kind of is now all of a sudden in real question. But the young man's statistics have not necessarily changed to where an argument can be made that he should not be given an opportunity. And there's a ton of teams in the National Football League that do not have a quarterback. I mean, you know, you're talking about the New York Jets. The Miami Dolphins are in flux right now. They're struggling. They're going to bring in a journeyman quarterback who never did much of anything the whole time he was at Chicago. You talk about the Baltimore Ravens, another team. They go out and take a look at an Arena League guy and give him a contract. So there are just a whole host of teams. The Denver Broncos were on TV last night. I didn't see anyone that blew you away that said that there's somebody that needed to necessarily start those people on their particular roster. The Jacksonville Jaguars have been struggling with Blake Bortles for several years. They did not pick up his fifth-year option. So clearly they're not necessarily happy with him. The Oakland Raiders last year, they had a tremendous regular season. They won 12 games. They got in the playoffs. Their quarterback got hurt. Had they had any kind of functional backup, then they clearly may have had an opportunity to take another step forward. So you have to just basically say that the owners in the National Football League, all 32, have decided that they are not going to give this young man an opportunity because of the backlash that they're afraid of from their season ticket owners, people who are sponsors, and other individuals that help support their franchise financially because of the position that he took off the field and the fact that he has been deemed someone that is unpatriotic because of his position that he was taking during the playing of the national anthem. That's the bottom line with this whole issue. It has nothing to do with the young man's skill set. This is a clear situation where he's been blackballed. Now, NFL owners have the prerogative to do that. I don't know if he can necessarily file any kind of litigation or a lawsuit. I don't think there's anything he can do. Maybe people like Spike Lee can facilitate political pressure. But at this point, there's not a lot that can be done. But no NFL owner can look in the camera and say that this young man is not getting an opportunity because of what he did off the field. No one can honestly say that. That is exactly the reason why he's not getting an opportunity. And I would have a lot of respect for owners if they simply said, okay, listen, we just can't take the hit because I'm too concerned about my season ticket owners and other sponsors. And so a certain level of honesty, I think, at least would be a somewhat of a silver lining, because clearly this is a young man that, you know, can help a football team. Hopefully something may happen as we get into the season to where some team finds itself in a situation where they don't have a whole lot of options and they extend him an opportunity, and maybe he has an opportunity to come out and show that he still has a skill set and maybe he can kind of put this behind him. But right now, I'm a little pessimistic as to whether or not he's going to really get another legitimate opportunity to play in the National Football League. And this is a very, very, very kind of sad thing, because in this country, people have the right to express themselves based upon the United States Constitution. You may be able to disagree with the individual, but that person should not necessarily be punished or not have an opportunity to earn a living simply because you disagree with from where they're coming from politically. And that's where we are right now. And it's a really kind of a sad story from my perspective.
Are you encouraged at all by the other NFL athletes who have supported him, or do you wish that there were more?
Well, I think that this is a very interesting kind of situation, because, again, it speaks to kind of a larger issue. In the 1960s, things were so difficult racially for African Americans in this country that, you know, Muhammad Ali really carried the torch in arguing and basically kind of changing the dynamics, in which he said, no, professional athletes, yes, you have an opportunity to earn a tremendous amount of money. You have an opportunity to have a tremendous amount of fame. You have an opportunity to be looked upon and glamorized and so on and so forth. But you also have a responsibility to maybe speak out on political issues and contemporary issues that professional athletes have not necessarily done in the past, particularly African Americans. Because for African Americans in professional sports, the idea for the longest, really from World War II up until about the 1960s was, hey, this is a privilege. Anytime you have an opportunity to play pro football or be a pro boxer or play pro baseball, keep your head down, and earn your money, and you stay out of any kind of political or kind of controversial issues. And Muhammad Ali said, no, that's not what you should do, that you still have to sleep at night. You have to feel good about how you feel as a man, as a person. And understand that you have an impact on an entire population, maybe even an entire country. So if you have an opportunity to maybe change something that is wrong, then you have the responsibility of maybe even sacrificing your career. So he was the first one to kind of create that whole ideology. And so in a sense, you know, others have kind of followed since him, and Kaepernick has kind of set the tone. I saw that Malcolm Jenkins, the Philadelphia Eagles, indicated that he's going to continue to raise his fists during the national anthem because he still feels like African-American males are being disproportionately shot and killed by police. You know, hey, I don't know if anyone can argue with that fact. Now, you can challenge Malcolm Jenkins in terms of, well, he's a professional athlete. He has this opportunity to play pro football. Is it his place? The national anthem, is this very patriotic, untouchable kind of tradition that's a part of the United States? You should not use that as a platform. Wait a minute now. Wait a minute. He has a right to make that kind of decision, and he's doing it because he understands fully that, hey, maybe this is the best way to bring attention to this problem. And so that's what kind of we really need to move forward and get to, not what these individuals are doing, which is a very kind of reactionary thing. They are reacting to things that have been taking place in this country that have not been addressed. We have not clearly addressed the problem of black males being shot and killed disproportionately by white police officers. When are we going to address that issue? That is a fact. That is something that continues to take place throughout this country. And so he is bringing attention to that, and I think that he has every right to do that. And people may disagree with the way he's doing it, but they need to also deal with why and the particular issue that he has taken on. And people are really kind of getting caught up into, well, it's the, you know, national anthem, so on and so forth. What Colin Kaepernick did, his fundamental take on treatment of African Americans in this country, particularly by police and other kind of, and racism and other things like that, you can't really necessarily challenge the young man on that. The issue is that he did it at a time under a tradition, under something that takes place before the football game that is kind of sacred. Well, you know, that's a very, very subjective kind of perspective that people can take. And so I think that, you know, other athletes probably are going to continue to do those kind of things as we continue to move forward and see, until we begin to see some change institutionally with police officers and other things in place that may potentially stop that kind of behavior. I think, you know, hey, I don't have an issue with professional athletes. I'm taking that risk and realizing that they could be ostracized, but I'm fully understanding that they feel like there's more at place and more at stake than my ability to simply play a professional sport and have an opportunity to have a certain amount of glory and fame.
Well, that's all the time we have for today, but thank you so much. Charles K. Ross is a professor of history at Ole Miss. One of his more recent books is Mavericks, Money and Men, the AFL, Black Players, and the Evolution of Modern Football. He's an expert on where social movements and sports collide. So, Dr. Ross, we'll have to have you back on soon. Thanks for joining us today.
Hey, I appreciate it. Thanks again for inviting me on.
Yeah, have a great day. We'll talk soon.
All right, you too.
Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams from the law offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today, in light of the events over the weekend, I thought we'd talk a little bit about the First Amendment. After watching the terribleness that unfolded over the weekend, and then everybody turned into constitutional First Amendment scholars on Facebook, I thought maybe I would speak a little bit about, number one, first of all, what the First Amendment actually means in terms of speech. The First Amendment, number one, actually talks about a whole lot of things. It doesn't just cover speech. It covers a whole lot of things. If you haven't looked at the First Amendment, I'd advise you to Google it or get out your pocket constitution, of which I do have, and take a gander at the First Amendment. But when we're talking about the First Amendment and speech, it only protects government interference from speech. It does not mean that you can say whatever you want, whenever you want, and everybody has to listen and respect your opinions, and there are not any consequences to having those opinions and speaking your thoughts. It only protects against government interference. So what that means is that if I say something that the general public doesn't like, that's fine. The general public cannot like it. But if the government tries to put me in jail, then that's not something that they can do. So there's been a lot of talk about whether or not some speech should be suppressed and what type of speech can and can't be protected. Whether or not particularly the neo-Nazi speech at the rally in Charlottesville was protected. When speech crosses that line from protected speech to incitement. And that's a legal term that has a whole bunch of case law about it, and it's a very difficult term to define, as one might expect. One of the, actually probably the biggest case about it, and the one that really set the test for whether or not speech is protected, and then a whole bunch of cases followed it to try to interpret it, is called Brandenburg v. Ohio, and that was back in 1969. It's a case about the Klan. It's got an interesting story that you can read about online, but essentially it set up a test that said speech is protected unless it is directed to inciting or producing imminent lawless action and is likely to produce or incite such action. Okay, so it became known as the Brandenburg test. There's three parts. You have to have intent. There has to be a likelihood that intent and the speech is going to cause immediate harm. So imminence, so it's intent, imminence, and then likelihood to cause immediate harm. Okay? So that's essentially the Brandenburg test. Now, as you might expect, that test in real life is kind of hard to put into practice. Like, when is words likely to incite immediate harm, particularly when actual immediate harm actually happens? Was the intent of the words at the rally to incite immediate harm, or was the intent of the words at the rally just to spew like normal, ugly words that white supremacists usually spew? So what is that line that crosses? Is it the fact that they had weapons? I don't know. North Carolina is an open carry state, so that makes it even more difficult when you mix in Second Amendment rights. Oh, Virginia, I'm sorry. It's an open carry state. That makes it even more difficult, because you have a whole Second Amendment issue there too. So just the fact of having an arm or a gun there maybe wasn't, because you have a right to a different constitutional right to have that arm. But maybe it was. The whole thing is that these different standards are always tested, and they're always shifting, because a lot of it has to do with prevailing societal norms and what is, you know, acceptable at the time. There's a whole case line about threats of violence and whether or not someone says, like, in a fit of political passion, oh, I feel like I want to do harm to such and such a political figure. The threat has to be an actual likelihood of threat. If it's just a statement of passion, then that's protected speech. If there's an actual likelihood that threat is actually going to happen, that's not protected speech. When a threat or hate speech becomes imminent, then it's not.
it's going to be very difficult to figure this out, and I actually expect to see some case law coming out of the actions over this weekend. That's all the time we have. Thank you for listening. Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela Williams with another edition of Know Your Right.
Thanks, Angie. And I've got the current edition of our calendar. This Saturday, the Wyandotte County Third Saturday Democratic Breakfast will take place at 8 a.m. for breakfast, 9 a.m. for the speaker. The speaker is John Gibson, the new Democratic Party chair of Kansas. And it's at a new location, Las Islas Marias, 7516 State Avenue, KCK. Workers' Rights Clinic for Victims of Wage Theft, Monday, August 21st, 5 to 8 p.m. at El Centro, 650 Minnesota Avenue, KCK. Faith in Action for Women's Equality Week, hosted by Stand Up KC, Wednesday, August 23rd, 7 to 8:30 a.m., St. Mark Hope and Peace Church, 3800 Troost in Kansas City, Missouri. If you want to get a ticket, go to eventbrite.com and look for Faith in Action. Northland Progress, In for 10, a voting rights festival with speakers, comedy, music, food, and, of course, beer. Saturday, August 26th, noon to 10 p.m., English Landing Park, Parkville, Missouri. And save the date, Labor Day morning for a big rally for workers. Monday, September 4th, 8 a.m., 33rd and Southwest Traffic Way in KCMO. And next week is Women's Equality Week. If you want to find the schedule, we'll link to it on our webpage, and that's heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can find tonight's show, our upcoming shows, and our archive. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. We will be celebrating Women's Equality Week by asking, why can't women TV anchors reach retirement on the job? And why Planned Parenthood is a feminist issue. Thanks to tonight's engineer, Jen Zaman. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special. You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.